Chapter 14. Tatton Park, near Manchester, England, 1942.
War on two fronts. National Service Act passed. Women called for duty.
Daily Pictorial.
When you land, I want to see you curl and roll to the side, and for bloody hell's sake, don't put your arms out as you hit the ground.
The instructor stared at the three women in particular.
If you do, you'll end up working as a shorthand typist.
He drew in his arms and wiggled his fingers as if he no longer had elbows, just hands attached to his shoulders.
Shorthand typist, get it?
The four men in the group laughed, while the women exchanged glances and offered desultory smiles.
Gorblimey, have a sense of humour, ladies.
Heard it all before, said Eleanor, though she spoke in German.
Right then, that's it. You won't mind being first up the tower, will you?
Not at all, sir, said Eleanor, this time in English, while hoping no one would notice the tremor in her voice. Ready to set an example, sir? The seven prospective Special Operations Executive Agents had arrived at Tatton Park, where RAF Ringway was based, a few days earlier, to begin parachute training. Knowing what would be demanded of her, Eleanor was now fitter than she had ever been in her life, though she was older than the other women training alongside her. One was 22, the other 25. Eleanor was 38, but more than one instructor had observed that she could have been taken for a woman 10 years her junior. It was her second jump from the tower, a tall wooden structure set up in an aircraft hangar for the recruits to practice landing without injury. The first jump was without the weight of a parachute strapped to her back. For this one, she wore a heavy pack on her back with a cord attached to practice releasing a parachute. Tomorrow would mark her first real exit from an aircraft, though the chute would open automatically. At least she hoped it would. Two more practice jumps would follow, but for those she would have to pull the cord, releasing the chute. Now, as she climbed the ladder up to the top of the tower, ready to jump and land on the padded mattress below, she felt as if her life over the past year was rushing before her, with a fleeting return of the same weakness she had felt in her legs when she began running toward the bombed and broken house, the home where her mother, grandmother, and sister lived. Not a night passed without Eleanor dreaming of the moment she stumbled, falling as she knelt down to pick up a scrap of thick scarlet fabric. It had come from her mother's favourite dress, her holiday dress, the one she wore for special occasions and would have been wearing to welcome Eleanor home for Easter. Charlotte loved every moment of the holiday, the precious days from Good Friday to Easter Sunday. Looking up, Eleanor had seen the remains of painted eggs and Easter decorations strewn among the rubble, along with books, china, splintered furniture, and all manner of broken and twisted household effects.
What are you looking for, miss? Perhaps we can help, but you should leave now, it's too dangerous.
Eleanor stared at the air raid precautions man in his uniform, at his helmet with ARP in big letters across the top, and his smile. It was a pained and mournful smile, as if etched onto skin in an instant when he had to chivy the broken-hearted and grieving on their way. My mother's jewellery box, it was beside her bed. It was very precious. It's where she kept letters from my late father. She wiped the back of her hand across her wet cheeks.
Jewellery box? Nah, haven't seen anything like that, miss.
He shook his head as if for effect.
If we had, it would have been turned in, you know, for you to collect from the police station.
Oh dear, I really hoped I could find it. Eleanor stared at the ground and kicked at some fallen masonry. She knew she would never see the jewellery box again. It had gone, most likely discovered and taken already. So it was true about the looting. If you find my father's letters, would you?
Of course, miss. Now then, you go and get yourself a nice cup of tea. The WVS ladies will look after you.
The loss of diamonds had no meaning for Eleanor, but she would have loved the letters.
And when you've all done this jump, you can go in and get yourself a nice cup of tea and a clean pair of trousers. The laundry room is on standby.
The instructor laughed at his own joke again.
Right then, up you go to the top of the tower, Snow White. Show this lot how it's done.
Eleanor ensured her helmet was secure, positioned well down over her ears with the strap tight. She stepped toward the tower and began climbing up the ladder toward the platform at the top. Reaching the launching point, she braced her shoulders, looked down, gave a thumbs up, and imagined a bird on the wing. She opened her arms, jumped, pulled the cord, drew her elbows in again, and a second later landed, curling to one side as her feet touched the ground. Her arms now firm against her chest when the instructor reached out to pull her up and off the mat.
Stellar display, stellar. Now then, who's next? I see that brave man is already at the step on his way up to prove he can do it. Let's see if you can best the lady here. And you youngsters, keep an eye on these two oldies, because they're making you look like gleaming trainee clowns. Looks like we're the two mature clowns in this round. Buy you a drink, Snow White.
Stephen Warren leaned on the bar, next to Eleanor. We should be using our assigned operational names, you know, to get used to them, said Eleanor. And a joke is rarely funny second time around, especially if the joker isn't amusing.
Sorry about that. And yes, you're right. We should be using operational names. Now, what the heck is your name?
He had forgotten every time their paths crossed since preliminary training at Wanborough. Mariana, and our jolly instructor shouldn't have mentioned my real name today.
Poor sod, probably can't remember the new one.
He's got a difficult job on his hands, so I wouldn't disparage him, eh, Luke?
I'm glad one of us has good recall. So, what's it to be, Mariana?
Warren winked. Eleanor laughed. Gin and tonic, thank you, Luke. Oh, and just to remind you, I've heard they try to get us drunk to find out if we tell secrets under the influence. Watch what the soldier barman puts in the glass.
That's better. A smile from the serious one. A nice G&T coming up, and I'll make sure it's not spiked with anything.
Warren caught the attention of the soldier tending the mess bar, ordered their drinks, and watched as the man prepared two cocktails before turning to Eleanor again.
So, what did you do before the war, housewife, lady of leisure?
Luke, you're not supposed to ask me questions about before the war. Suffice it to say, I speak several languages and was recruited based upon those skills. Apparently, the fact that I was a teacher helped.
How on earth does that help?
Well, Luke, there's the ability to assess up to about 30 personalities in double-quick time, as well as being able to explain a tricky concept so that even the most troublesome perisher understands. She smiled. The Lukes of this world.
All right, I get your point. But you're not too shabby with the firearms, either. I was with the police, so take that as a compliment.
You can't stop yourself, can you? You've given me a hard job, Luke, because now that's something else I've got to forget. Plus, I've told you too much already. Let it be said it's best we keep stumm about our past lives.
Bloody hell, I've done it again. It's like being at school. I was forever walking on tiptoes as a lad, wondering what I could say or not say without getting a clip around the ear.
Eleanor sipped her drink. It's called discipline, and it can save your life and mine if we're sent out together. Bad for me, as it looks like that's exactly what will happen.
I'll ignore that one. But what do you think of the girl with the radio, you know, the blonde? I think she's supposed to be coming with us.
As long as she can do her job and do it well, that's the most important thing. They were silent for a moment or two.
You want to ask me something, don't you? Said Warren.
Eleanor smiled. I suppose so, but it's an out-of-bounds question.
Go on.
Why are you being deployed to Belgium? Why not France?
It's my accent. I was a scholarship boy at a good school and by some miracle became fluent in French, but because my mother was Dutch, when I natter in French, I have this little touch to my locution that's a bit different, and the powers that be decided I would be better suited to Belgium. Apparently, there's a number of recruits who happen to speak French or Belgian because their fathers brought home brides after the last war, so they learned another language. Now the Special Operations Executive has nabbed them. As for me, I don't actually speak Dutch. Well, I managed to get by for the one afternoon spent with my gran in Rotterdam, but I'm not exactly fluent. You?
Born in Belgium. I was 14 when I came to London.
Oh, so you were there during the last war, the German occupation.
We should stop before we say anything else about the past.
You've got what we call previous, then.
What?
Copper talk for a con with a conviction or two under his belt. You could say a prior experience of something. It's your second occupation go-round, so you've got previous.
Oh.
Another one? He lifted his glass.
I've barely touched this one yet.
Drink up then, Lieutenant. Don't let the first aid nursing yeomanry down.
Mariana, I hope I don't have to keep reminding you.
Sorry, and if you don't mind my saying so, I think a Wren's uniform would have been a better cover for you on home turf, not the FANY. Navy is more your colour.
Oh, give it a rest, Luke, or you'll be the first casualty next time we're on the firing range.
Following parachute training, Eleanor and other members of the group were sent to Bewley in Hampshire, the country seat of Lord Montague, though it was now requisitioned by the government for what was described as the finishing school for SOE recruits. It would be their base while they endured an advanced skills course designed both to save their own lives and bring an enemy's time on Earth to a swift end. Having commenced her preliminary training at another grand estate, Wanborough, near Guildford, Eleanor at last understood why recruits and instructors alike referred to the SOE as stately homes and estates in jest. They were being trained for the ultimate in discomfort, the worst that might befall them as they worked to set Europe ablaze. Yet while facing one test after another, they were domiciled in manor houses, offering a level of splendour that had hitherto been reserved for the exclusive comfort of the aristocracy, or discomfort, given that most of those manor houses were cold and draughty. At the end of each day, Eleanor felt as if her joints were being pulled apart, the intensive training taking recruits from shooting, where they were introduced to the Sten gun, the Liberator pistol, and a plethora of other weapons, to the skills required to kill someone in silence, which for Eleanor was not a new lesson, instead more of a refresher course. A key to their future, however long it might last, was preparedness for a clandestine life while having to appear ordinary every single day in a country occupied by the enemy. Falling into bed one night, beyond tired and having only picked her way around a fish supper, Eleanor listed into a deep sleep, only to have her arm almost pulled from its socket, while a light so bright it all but pierced her brain was directed into her eyes. Hauled from the bed by the Gestapo, she was dragged down a staircase she never knew existed and thrown into a dark cellar, enveloped in blackness until another light illuminated the dank, fetid space around her, and she was tied to a single chair with a German guard at the door. So began her interrogation. Hours passed, darkness, light, sometimes too much light, at the whim of her captors. Her chair taken so, she crumpled to the floor, with only thin pyjamas between her and the frigid night. Or was it day? Time and again she was questioned. State your name, your nationality. Where do you live? What do you do? Tell me your name. Know your real name. Then the tactic changed. A kindly Gestapo officer entered with a chair, helped her to take the seat and offered her a cigarette, shrugging when she shook her head.
Come on, my dear, do answer our questions, then you can go home.
The officer left the room, and another replaced him, walking to her, slapping her across the face and dragging the chair away again so she hit the ground hard. Names, expletives, the officer speaking in German, French, English, and she only ever responding in Belgian French. He kicked her again, threw a lighted cigarette down so it hit her on the back, singeing the fabric of her pyjamas, and left the cellar, turning out the light as he departed. She coughed, phlegm racked hard from her lungs, the bitter cold leaching from the floor into her skin. Was she in France? Was this a nightmare? She slept. Sounds outside filtered into the cellar. Eleanor braced, ready for more brutality, more blinding light, more questions. She sat up and pulled herself into the corner alongside the door. She massaged her legs, thumped her thighs, found her strength and came to her feet. She waited behind the door. The handle turned, the door opened. The single bright bulb flickered into life. The first Gestapo officer entered the room. Eleanor summoned all her remaining strength to move fast, and in a split second his neck was held tight in the crook of her elbow. With another swift move, she slammed him into the wall and kneed him in the groin. The officer doubled over.
"I say, old girl, steady on."
The officer coughed.
"I was only coming in to free you up. You don't want to miss another supper."
He came to his feet, clutching his crotch.
"Good Lord, you almost took my manhood."
"Sorry, sir." She caught her breath, sweeping a lock of sweat-soaked hair from her face. "But you had it coming."
"Ariana, take this as a warning. Yes, you've done well. Not every SOE recruit can endure some 30 hours of intense interrogation, but ordinary Belgian women going about their business don't usually know how to get one over on the Gestapo. And what would you do then after you've crippled Gruppenführer Lost Balls? Think you can knee your way through an army of guards? They'll know everything they need to know about you as soon as you wrap an arm around the guard's neck and whack him in the kidneys, so let's call that a lesson learned, eh? The last thing we want is you in front of a firing squad and an entire resistance line shredded."
He blew out his cheeks and shook his head.
"Mind you, that knee will come in handy if you're stopped by a lonely Nazi while you're riding your bike along a country road."
"Doesn't every father show his daughter how to use her knee?"
"Did yours?"
"No, but someone else taught me a couple of handy lessons." Natalie, the young woman Eleanor thought might become the radio operator accompanying herself and Warren, Luke, to Belgium, broke her right clavicle, scapula, and ankle during her second parachute jump. She had been sent to another location to recover and, in all likelihood, to end up in a desk job. Though Eleanor hoped, for the woman's sake, not in a clerical role, by now everyone knew the parachute instructor's joke. Another radio operator would be assigned in due course, but selecting an agent for Belgium was not as straightforward as it was for the French section. In the meantime, Eleanor's role was clear. Her remit during deployment into occupied Belgium was to strengthen a resistance line that included establishing new escape routes for Allied airmen who had been shot down and survived. The resistance line would also carry out acts of sabotage and intelligence gathering, and in time would prepare for the Allied invasion of occupied territories, the end goal that everyone expected, and soon, they hoped. Given childhood memories of her work with La Dame Blanche, Eleanor was under no illusions regarding the difficulty involved in every single operation. The training had been long and arduous at times, and now she just wanted to get over to Belgium to do her bit, as the British said. She considered it a strange phrase, not least because it levelled the risking of life on the battlefield, in the air or at sea, into something quite small, a bit. Not a lot, just a bit. It was the limited portion anyone could be expected to accomplish in a time of war, though it was a phrase used in peacetime too. "Go out and do your bit," Miss Doncaster had instructed the hockey team at St. Joseph's. On the other hand, perhaps the bit was typical British understatement. After all, every citizen was expected to serve, to do their bit, and charge an invading enemy with whatever they had to hand, hockey sticks included. Even children were being trained in unarmed and armed combat, just in case. But this was far from a game. There had been no beating about the bush during her training. The life expectancy of an agent in the field was about 6 weeks. 6 weeks. Could she expect that in just 6 weeks she might be free of the stiletto of pain that had run through her heart and taken up residence when she stared at the remains of her grandmother's house while holding a shred of scarlet fabric in her hands? If so, she might greet death as a blessed release. In two wars she would have done more than her bit. The newly minted Special Operations Executive Agents were now situated at another manor house in Hampshire, where they waited to receive orders. Each morning they came down from their well-appointed quarters, and as they entered the dining room where breakfast was served, they would stop to look at the blackboard. If their name had been chalked on the board, they were now on the flight plan to depart for the field of operations that night under cover of darkness. It was their time, and from that moment the clock was ticking. Eleanor, Stephen Warren, and two others had been at the house for some 10 days. 10 days during which Eleanor went for long runs every morning to maintain fitness for deployment. 10 days when she saw men and women, one by one or in pairs, stare at the board before breakfast, knowing it would be their last in England for some time, perhaps even the last of their lives, lives that might only extend for another 6 weeks or 6 days. To kill time, Eleanor engaged in more target practice, and with a willing partner she became even more skilled in unarmed combat, faster, more precise and effective with every move, and against her better judgment, she and Stephen Warren became lovers. Returning from a 10-mile cross-country run one day, Eleanor took the stairs two at a time and went directly to her room, unlocked the door, and was only half surprised to see Claire Fields seated in an armchair alongside the window, now open wide to allow the escape of cigarette smoke. Fields came to her feet, pinched the end of the cigarette, and ran it under the cold tap at the sink in the corner of the room, then threw the remains into the wastebasket. "I should check to make sure you haven't left any vital information scribbled on those discarded papers," said Fields. "You know better than to suggest such a thing to me, Claire," said Eleanor. "You know I wouldn't be that stupid. Why are you here?"
"I thought I should pay you a visit for old time's sake, Linny."
"My name is Mariana."
"Yes, of course. Sorry about that. And you've forged a friendship with Luke. In fact, I believe you've become best mates."
Eleanor looked away.
"If I didn't need you both in Belgium sooner rather than later, believe me, one of you would be out doing some sort of boring menial field work in deepest Wales, and at this very moment I am sorry to say it would not be you."
Fields, dressed in the uniform of the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry, approached Eleanor and stood in front of her. "It took me a while to recruit you. But I persisted, because I knew you would be one of the best. So how could you be so bloody stupid? You of all people, Linny, and I'm using your real name because never in my wildest dreams did I think you would make such an error. Eleanor DeWitt, you've shocked me. I would have trusted you above everyone else. I've recruited for this work."
"I'm sorry, Claire, I..."
"Commander Fields."
"Yes, Commander Fields, I will disengage myself from any further involvement with Luke beyond our work in Belgium."
"Nicely said. Textbook apology. Now, for bloody hell's sake, keep your promise. I didn't bring you out of Belgium in the last war to make an idiot of yourself years later in the SOE. I've put my trust in you, Captain White."
She turned away, shaking her head. "And yes, you've been promoted, though God knows I'd like to roll back my reference on that one."
Eleanor said nothing. She knew there was more to come.
"There's something else," said Fields, now facing Eleanor once again. "You must keep to your promise and end the liaison because I need, yes, need.
Oh dear, unfortunate word that one. Anyway, I need you to be absolute in your independence of mind."
"I don't understand, Commander Fields."
"Of course you don't, which is why I'm going to explain myself."
Fields folded her arms as if to form a shield.
"Oh, for God's sake, sit down."
Eleanor followed the instruction, taking a seat on the second armchair set underneath the window. Fields took the other chair, once again facing her.
"Here's a nagging problem we are dealing with at SOE HQ. As you know, the Prime Minister instructed us to set Europe ablaze with our irregular methods of intelligence gathering, sabotage of the enemy, resistance to their occupations of allied countries, and the protection of our airmen, who find themselves on the ground, vulnerable and far from home. And as you also know, the PM believes women to be as good, if not better than men, when it comes to the execution of the section's plans. We work well alone, and we know how to keep secrets."
"Yes."
"Right. Well, what you may not know is anything about the competition and often downright rancor with which we are viewed by other government departments."
She shook her head.
"The Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, has their knickers in a twist, claiming we are nothing but incompetence, comprising felons, failures and, well, pick any disparaging word beginning with F and you pretty much have it. Naval intelligence is on the warpath, along with every known allied intelligence department. Half the time we don't know who's for us or against us. Intelligence has always been an old boys' network of disparate officers, so they don't take kindly to us recruiting from what they consider to be the lower classes. Women fall into that category. And the fact that we've found a very motley assortment of first-class operatives who have linguistic and other skills has bent the old boys out of shape. Mind you, the Americans are interested and have taken to the idea of the SOE. For all their pomp and bluster, the Yanks like a maverick approach to war and are following suit.
Commander Fields, what has this to do with me?
Fields sighed and shook her head, her lips pressed together. Eleanor thought the woman she had known for a long time was in a personal tussle to stop herself saying more. She knew her superior would fail in the attempt.
White, I have known you from valiant young girl to courageous woman, and I believe there are even greater resources of spirit inside you to draw upon as you keep yourself and others in your circle safe and operational. But you must not reveal this conversation.
It will remain between us.
Even as she offered words of reassurance, she felt Commander Claire Fields staring at her, testing her with her eyes.
I can't put my finger on it, said Fields, but I don't trust your lover any farther than I could throw him.
Eleanor stared at Fields and thought she might laugh. Commander Fields, I've already thought working with Luke, might occasionally be difficult because he sees things in such a light-hearted way. He's a bit too much of a jester at times, but throughout our training he's taken each task very seriously. He knows the gravity demanded of his job.
It's the Joker that worries me. I saw it when you were based in Bully, and I saw it on every occasion when I was engaged in monitoring training.
Sorry, you didn't even know I was there. All part of my clandestine work. Yes, I'll concede he kept everyone's spirits up, and yes, every word out of his mouth was passable French in a serviceable locution for Belgium. However, he is very well connected, and it was a reference from another department that secured his entry to the SOE.
Who recommended him?
You know I can't tell you that. Suffice it to say, it's the old school tie again. But his exemplary, if somewhat non-conformist, police work with Scotland Yard's special branch was also considered before we recruited him. He's just a little more irregular than the rest of us.
Fields stood up and glanced at her watch.
Be careful. Watch him. I hope I'm wrong, but there's something amiss. As I said, it's an element I cannot put my finger on, though I have my suspicions. There are secrets kept from me, too, so I sometimes engage in rather wild thinking. It's surprising how often I'm right, though. I'm always more than happy to be wrong.
Eleanor came to her feet. You can depend upon me to be vigilant, Commander Fields.
Fields nodded, placing a hand on Eleanor's shoulder.
Yes, I know that, Linny, Captain White, she smiled.
You will do us proud, Mariana. I would trust you with my life.
And I would trust you.
Claire Fields smiled again.
Thank you.
She stepped toward the door and stopped as she reached for the handle.
Have a good supper and get a good night's sleep. You leave for Belgium tomorrow evening.
It was the shovel strapped to her leg that concerned Eleanor most. The tool was one of several items of equipment she would have about her person as she jumped from the Westland Lysander aircraft. On her practice jumps, she had worried that the shovel might be a liability, as it pressed against her shin like a splint against bone. She wore day clothing underneath the overalls. Every item of attire and her shoes had been checked and checked again for anything revealing her country of origin. She had heard about the recruit reprimanded when an officer went through his pockets before he boarded the aircraft, only to find a London bus ticket. She felt the parachute bulky at her back and knew she would be lying if she said she had no fear. Taking another deep breath in an effort to settle her fast-beating heart, she felt for the semi-automatic pistol and knife issued in preparation for her departure. She could still hear the instructor's words,
"Shove that dagger in hard, right between the enemy's ribs, and then bring it up fast with a strong thrust. It'll be harder than you imagine. Or just stab the bastard and keep on going at it once he's down. Save your bacon, because I want to take you to the pictures when the war's over."
Another joke, another verbal sheet of festive paper wrapped around the gift of training designed to save her life.
"Time for the off," said Warren, leaning toward her. "Sit you down there, Mariana. Remember, you were the best of the bunch in training for this falling out of aeroplanes lark."
Eleanor nodded and gave her fellow operative the thumbs up. Since the unannounced visit from Claire Fields, she had felt herself gnawing away at the woman's warning as if she were a dog trying to suck marrow from a bone. Yet in that moment, as Steve Warren leaned toward her, offering words of encouragement, she trusted him. "She's wrong this time," thought Eleanor, as the aircraft door was drawn back and the sharp, cold wind hit her face. She took her position, gave the thumbs up again, and did not look down as she jumped, pulling the cord to release the parachute at the perfect moment when she was clear of the aircraft. Seconds later, she made a faultless landing. She was quick to free herself from the parachute, to catch and roll up the white billowing silk, and to unstrap the shovel, ready to go about the business of burying everything but the clothes she stood up in and the small suitcase brought down with her. It had taken only minutes for her to make herself presentable in attire and footwear more suited to a woman selling cosmetics door to door. As she waited for Luke to join her, he had landed some yards away, she exhaled. The first part was done. Yet as a reminder of what might come next, she touched the pocket close to her chest where she had slipped in the L-pill issued before departure. It was the lethal cyanide pill she would use to take her own life if any part of her remit failed and she was captured by the Gestapo. But now she was on firm ground, ready to get to work.
"Thank heavens that's over," whispered the newly christened Mariana. "I'd make a terrible shorthand typist."